Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on SunSounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, October 5th, 2025. Across the country, most school districts have fall breaks in October. Many families decide to spend their fall break in national parks. Now, with the government shutdown that began Wednesday, October 1st, many are checking the news to find out what parks are open and which are not. From the Washington Post, by the way, a travel compilation. What's open during the shutdown? A running list for travelers. National parks are open with limited staffing, but sites such as the Liberty Bell and the Washington Monument are closed. Updated Friday, October 3rd at 1:45 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. This article written by Hannah Sampson, Andrea Sachs, and Natalie B. Compton. The shutdown of the federal government this week has sent some travelers into a state of disappointment and confusion as they weigh plans to visit properties managed by the National Park Service. While outdoor national parks remain largely open, there are no workers to staff some historic sites and visitor centers or direct some tours. Some sites are closed off, some are allowed to stay open, or left in a partially functioning state. Figuring out what is still accessible requires legwork. Specific information has been sparse on government websites that are typically updated to reflect weather emergencies and traffic anomalies. Air travel will continue mostly unimpeded. Transportation Security Administration officers and air traffic controllers have exemptions to work without pay, which could contribute to long lines and delays. As of Friday, most park system websites carried a uniform message with scarce information. National parks remain as accessible as possible during the federal government shutdown. However, some services may be limited or unavailable. They directed people to a site that shares the Interior Department's contingency plan, but not location-specific information. Social media pages echoed the non-specific language for the most part, leaving potential visitors to beg for more information in the comments. "I guess I have to drive there to see if the gate is closed," one person wrote on the Facebook page for Shenandoah National Park. The park and its hotels and campgrounds are open, while visitor centers are not. A message on recreation.gov, a federal travel planning site and reservation system, said it would stay operational during the shutdown, but customers might not be able to complete future reservations or purchases for passes. People with reservations at shuttered locations might get an email with more information, the site said, or might not. It directed people to check local offices or agency websites directly. Bill Wade, executive director of the Association of National Park Rangers, said the parks were already operating with skeleton crews because of a nearly 25% reduction in permanent National Park Service staffers that occurred earlier this year. According to the National Parks Conservation Association, the system could lose more than $1 million in fee revenue every day buildings are closed. Nearly two-thirds of the Park Service, more than 9,000 people, have been furloughed. To protect the parks, Wade recommends that visitors follow some of the golden rules of backcountry hiking, such as pack it in, pack it out, including waste, and carrying your own supply of toilet paper. He also urges people not to do anything stupid, because the response times of search and rescue or law enforcement might be slower than usual. Be a little more careful so you don't get in trouble and have to rely on an already very short-staffed park, Wade said. National park sites that are open. Grand Canyon, according to the Grand Canyon Conservancy, the park's nonprofit partner, a lot is open. Roads, lookouts, trails, and campgrounds, plus its retail stores, the Kolb Studio Art Gallery, Desert View Watchtower, and the Backcountry Information Center. Ranger-led programs and tours have been canceled. Collection fee booths and park service buildings, such as visitor centers, are closed. The Conservancy will still hold events. Visitors should check for location changes. Amenities and services run by third parties are available, including lodging, restaurants, bicycle rentals, tours, and park shuttles. Commercial river trips are still on. Yellowstone. A statement posted by the vendor running lodges at Yellowstone National Park says entrances and roads will remain accessible. Lodges, restaurants, gift shops, and bathrooms will remain open. Yosemite. According to the Yosemite Conservancy, gates are open but unstaffed. Roads, trails, campgrounds, and backcountry and wilderness areas remain open. The Conservancy will keep running its art classes and volunteer programs. Lodging, hotels, stores, and restaurants are open. Utah National Parks. The state's five national parks, Arches, Canyonlands, Capitol Reef, Zion, and Bryce Canyon, are open. But some services are limited. The Utah Office of Tourism announced Friday that the Governor's Office of Economic Opportunity will cover expenses for visitor centers to continue operating at the five national parks and Cedar Breaks National Park. Colorado National Park sites. The eight sites in Colorado that collect fees, Rocky Mountain National Park, Black Canyon of the Gunnison, Colorado National Monument, Dinosaur National Monument, Florissant Fossil Beds National Monument, Great Sand Dunes, Hovenweep National Monument, and Mesa Verde National Park will continue to operate on fee revenue. Visitor centers and historic buildings will be closed, but gates will stay open and custodial services will continue, according to the governor's office. The state expects those sites to stay open until fee revenue dries up. In Hawaii, Haleakala National Park in Maui is open with advanced reservations for sunrise. Hawaii Volcanoes National Park has limited services and facilities. The Welcome Center at Kilauea Military Camp, Volcano Art Gallery, and Volcano House are open. Kilauea Point National Wildlife Refuge in Kauai is open with advanced reservations. The Visitor Center and Gift Shop are closed. Pearl Harbor. Historic sites in Hawaii, including Pearl Harbor National Memorial, home of the USS Arizona Memorial, Battleship Missouri Memorial, Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum, Pacific Fleet Submarine Museum, and USS Bowfin Submarine will remain open and operate at normal hours during the government shutdown. Mount Rushmore. Travelers can still visit the South Dakota National Memorial. Restrooms, restaurants, and the gift shop remain open. D.C. Museums and Monuments. For now, many of the most popular are open. The Smithsonian Institution, which curates 17 museums in the city and the National Zoo, said on Friday that all of its properties will remain open to the public. Locations will be closed starting October 12th if the shutdown continues. The Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island in New York, which are reachable by ferry, remain open. Kennedy Space Center in Florida, the visitor complex, which is operated by a NASA contractor, is also open. Exhibits and attractions are available, according to the website. And parks and monuments that are closed. The Liberty Bell Center in Philadelphia's Independence National Historical Park is closed, as well as the Gateway Arch in St. Louis. Carlsbad Caverns. The entry to the New Mexico Caverns, access to the visitor center, roads leading into the park, and nighttime bat flight programs are not available during the shutdown. The Petrified Forest in Arizona, famous for its fossils, ancient village, and painted desert, is completely closed. Alcatraz Island, the famous prison in the center of San Francisco Bay, is closed, as well as Muir Woods, the national monument north of San Francisco. The Washington Post published an article reviewing the state of national parks after major funding cuts, published on July 30, 2025. Four reporters visited four different national parks, which I am pleased to say are all still open. The first was Mammoth Cave in Kentucky. The second, Glacier National Park in Montana. The third, Acadia National Park in Maine. And the fourth, Zion National Park, one of the Big Five, in Utah. That article appeared on the August 3, 2025 program, and you can hear it again now. In beloved national parks, summer crowds throng despite budget cuts. To see how the parks are faring amid the turmoil, Washington Post reporters visited four just before peak summer season. The four who visited found that changes so far were subtle, though staff cautioned that issues might emerge in coming months. The National Park Service did not respond to a request for comment. The four parks visited were Mammoth Cave in Kentucky, Glacier National Park in Montana, Acadia in Maine, and Zion National Park in Utah, Utah's first national park. Weeks into summer, millions of tourists are again streaming by car, camper, boat, and hiking boot to America's national parks. The 63 sites, spanning deserts and peaks, swamps and beaches, are among the most visited and most revered spots on the continent, postcard-ready emblems of a vast country proud of its public lands and awe-igniting scenery. But the summer of 2025 is unlike any before. The National Park Service, like other federal agencies, has been hit hard by the president's government reorganization. Firings, early retirements, and job freezes have diminished the long underfunded system's permanent employees by nearly a quarter, according to the National Parks Conservation Association. As of July, the advocacy group tallied, just over half of the target number of seasonal workers had been hired to help manage the crowds. Ominous signs of the impact surfaced this spring. Some visitor centers and campgrounds were temporarily closed because of staffing shortages, as was Arches National Park's famed Fiery Furnace Trail in Utah. Ranger-led tours and programs in other parks were curtailed. The superintendent resigned at Crater Lake National Park in Oregon, citing frustration with the cuts and what he called the agency's dismantlement. Park employees warned of long-term consequences, including hamstrung search and rescue operations and the demise of behind-the-scenes scientific research. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, who oversees the agency, has said he is focused on reducing bureaucracy, cutting workers who labor at desks, not on the ground. He ordered all sites to remain open and accessible and promised they would have the staffing to ensure visitors enjoy our nation's most treasured places. To see how the parks are faring amid the turmoil, four Washington Post reporters visited four just before peak summer season. As I said in the beginning of this article, Mammoth Cave in Kentucky, Glacier National Park in Montana, Acadia in Maine, and Zion National Park in Utah. And no matter the location, our reporters found profound affection for America's crown jewels, as the national parks have historically been described, strong support for their protection and vivid concern over what the cuts will mean in the years to come. Mammoth Cave, Kentucky, 747,042 visitors in 2024. The darkness inside Mammoth Cave feels so complete, it's like being swaddled in an inky black blanket. I heard myself letting out a breathy wow as my eyes slowly adjusted to the lighting installed for human intruders. Illumination dim enough to not disturb the cave crickets and thumb-sized bats at home in the cave's vast rooms. And that plunk of moisture drip-dropping from overhead? A cave kiss, Ranger Hillary tells my group, when we reach a part of this underground world where stalactites glisten. This is the essence of the Mammoth Cave National Park experience, novelty and wonder from the natural environment, fused with history and storytelling from a core of enthusiastic rangers. Unlike other places where visitors are free to roam, the only way to explore is through a ticketed tour, nearly all ranger-led. In April, Burgum came to Mammoth Cave to tout his commitment to maintaining all national parks, despite the budget cuts. America's best idea was the national park system, beloved by everyone, he said while on a tour. We know we have to take care of the parks. The secretary's words drew skepticism from employees system-wide, including here. Several were eager to talk this month, though on the condition of anonymity because of fears of reprisal. The pretty face of the NPS, meaning upbeat staff, tidy amenities, well-tended trails, mask low morale, frozen pay, and frustrations over having to do less with less, a second-year ranger told me. Mammoth Cave regained at least some of the positions initially cut. Yet with the year's late start for the hiring of seasonal workers, tour capacity has remained lower. The 2,300 daily ticket spots could be expanded by 400 to 500 more with the full workforce, according to another ranger. Lori Foster of Houston suspected as much when she found most tours had sold out in advance. "I'm sure they didn't have enough guides to go around," she said, age 38, who runs a management consulting business with her husband. They were traveling the country, park after park, in an RV with their three young boys, and she'd had a tough time getting tickets. She ultimately had to settle for a self-guided tour, the only option left for a party their size. Mammoth Cave was the family's 12th national park this year, and it was hard to tell who was the most excited to descend hundreds of feet into the earth. Benjamin Foster, 45, and a self-described political moderate, demurred on sharing his stronger opinions on the administration's funding cuts, but, with his sons in mind, stressed the absolutely imperative need for the parks to receive more money. "When I think about how much technology is involved in their life," says the father of the three sons, "how much AI is going to be a part of what we do, what's really going to be unique about the future is the experience that you have in the real world," he said. "To be able to come and see this and really feel it, breathe it, touch it, is really pretty special." Mammoth Cave boasts superlatives that other parks can only dream of. World's longest known cave system, UNESCO World Heritage Site. In its otherworldly recesses, parents rejoice over the lack of Wi-Fi, which makes children focus on what's around them. Stephen Spencer, 54, who works in environmental waste management, has been coming to Mammoth Cave since he was a kid in Kentucky. "I met him on the way to the historic entrance, the main access point used by Indigenous Americans seeking shelter millennia ago, and much later by explorers and saltpeter miners. This is where our parents took us and where we learned a lot," Spencer said as he chased after a 2-year-old grandson. "I'd hate to see that die." The portion of this article about Mammoth Cave was written by Kim Bellware. A parks fact. The National Park Service oversees 85 million acres that encompass national parks, battlefields, historical parks, lakeshores, monuments, recreation areas, and more. Next, Glacier National Park in Montana. 3,208,755 visitors in 2024. Technically, it was summer, but Glacier seemed to still be exiting winter. The park's main artery, Going to the Sun Road, had temporarily closed because of snowfall days before. Patches of ice dotted the landscape as the route climbed 3,500 feet from the west entrance to Logan Pass, and around each bend was another soaring peak, another gushing waterfall, another glimpse of bighorn sheep on slopes of scree. Glacier felt almost sacred to me, too magnificent to be tainted by political disputes in Washington. But I knew that many people feared the budget cuts there would be felt in the wilderness here, a place where crowds have been managed by a reservation system since 2021. While current and former staffers said seasonal hiring seemed not much below normal levels, they were braced for calamity with certain scenarios. A missing hiker, for instance, or a wildfire threatening Glacier's forests. "There will be delayed response to emergency events," Gary Moses, a former ranger, told me. "I wouldn't say if, I would say when." Basic services appeared to be running smoothly as the park's busiest period neared. Bathrooms were open and clean, trails were busy but tidy, and the park's distinctive red buses were only occasionally slowed by traffic backups. differences were more evident between the lines. Park calendars showed that only about two-thirds the number of ranger-led tours were on the schedule, compared with the same day the year before. Their concerns about changes under the Trump administration drew science teacher Heather Holt and her husband from Jupiter, Florida. The couple had flown to Utah and already road-tripped to Capitol Reef, Arches, Canyonlands, and Yellowstone National Parks, starting hikes before dawn to beat the heat and hordes of tourists. They then continued north, almost to the Canadian border, to reach this region known as the crown of the continent. And now they were watching the sunrise, just past 5:30 a.m., over glassy Lake McDonald. "We decided we better come see the national parks before some lunatic destroys them," the 50-year-old Holt said, a dig aimed specifically at the president. That same morning found Josh Beckley and Alec Chin fueling up with coffee at the century-old Lake McDonald Lodge. The pair from Hartford, Connecticut, were on the second day of their big hike trip in the West. Day one had featured a trek to the glacier-fed Avalanche Lake. "Unbelievable," described Beckley, 24, a software engineer and first-time visitor. They'd been a bit frustrated, though, by the lack of rangers or guides to answer questions at some of the spots they hit. "Some people kind of complain that, like, tax dollars go here and here and here," said Chin, 25. "But this is one of those things where it's like I would gladly pay into it. Up at Logan Pass, I was admiring fields of yellow glacier lilies when I met Janet and Mike Dimes, a couple in their late 60s from Frederick, Maryland. Both are Trumpers," said Mike, a former safety director, "and have faith the president loves the country." Yet they sounded torn over the administration's budget targets, bringing up government waste, even as they acknowledged they didn't want the national parks to suffer cuts. "We love the parks," stressed Janet, a retired bookkeeper. "It's just that the country needs to pare down," she said. "We spend way too much on stupid stuff." They were visiting Glacier for the second year in a row, wildfires having interrupted their 2024 adventure. Around them, visitors, hooded up given the chilly gusts, smiled for selfies. A bold marmot skittered around their feet. "This is a place people come back to," Mike said. And this portion of the article about Glacier National Park in Montana was filed by Karen Brouillard. And a park fact. In 2024, nearly 332 million people visited the national parks, an all-time high, up by more than 24 million people from a decade earlier. Acadia in Maine, 3,961,661 visitors in 2024. People sometimes speak about their happy place, where their soul is at peace or their senses come alive. For retired carpenter Jeffrey Wellman, Acadia is that place, and has been since I had my first diaper on, he says, 70 years ago. "It's not just one thing, it's the whole thing," explained Wellman, who grew up in Maine but now lives in Marlborough, Massachusetts. "We get the ocean, we get the forests, we get the inland beaches. It's just a paradise." Wellman, for one, thinks he's found a sliver of silver lining to the national park's funding cuts. "Word of those budget woes have encouraged visitors here to have more respect for the park," he said. "It used to be that people would leave all their trash around, but I'm noticing a lot more people are taking all their waste away." "But as I drove and hiked around Acadia, which for 25 years has also been my happy place, I found that other tourists and locals couldn't shake their concerns about the future." Alyssa Goodstein, communications director for the Illinois AFL-CIO in Chicago, had just completed her first hikes on her first visit when I met her in a parking lot that provides access to Beach Mountain via several trails. "The funding cuts were the impetus for her trip," said Goodstein, 37, a women in construction ball cap atop her head. "I'm really afraid about what's happening to our national parks." Part of the allure of Acadia, which occupies about half of Mount Desert Island, traces to its special history in this coastal range of Maine, known as Down East. In the early 20th century, John Rockefeller Jr. gave thousands of acres and financed and played a key role in the construction of the park's iconic carriage roads and stone bridges. And the Friends of Acadia, an independent nonprofit, has long supported the park as its official philanthropic partner. Full disclosure, my husband and I have been donors. Eric Stiles, the group's president and chief executive, reminded me that Acadia's carriage roads were beset by real neglect that peaked in the 70s and 80s. Restoration took the ensuing decades, and he's worried about what happens in the park during this Trump administration. Acadia takes continual care and feeding, Stiles said, adding that should the current cuts hold and the projected cuts happen, what visitors see and experience would be highly impacted and visible in 5 to 10 years. We need the hiring freeze to be lifted, he said. That is absolutely essential. His worries extend to the small picturesque towns that share the island with the park. He noted that Acadia brings in $685 million annually for the local economy. Down East Maine rises or falls with Acadia, he said. So far, it's been rising, and there's too much at stake to not allow the park to operate with certainty. On a carriage road not far from the Jordan Pond House, a tourist favorite for its popovers, expansive lawn, and scenic view, I met Brad Jordan on a bike ride with friends. He's no relation to the clan for which the pond was named, but he's still deeply tied to the park through his business, Maine State Kayak and E-Bike. It has two locations in the immediate area that depend on vacationers to Acadia. When the administration earlier this year was axing thousands of federal workers, including park rangers, and freezing open positions, some of Jordan's customers delayed committing to their summer plans. That made his own staffing decisions more difficult. People were definitely holding off from reserving in advance, he said. While his numbers are now slightly ahead of last year's, he still has longer-term misgivings. Anytime you're cutting federal funds to a national park, he said, it's detrimental in terms of safety. At the Beach Mountain Trailhead, first-time visitor Goldstein offered an even stronger defense. Our national parks are the lungs of our country, she said. They represent some of the best places. And this portion of the article, written about Acadia National Park in Maine, was written by Karen Miller Pinciero. A park fact. The National Park Service's fiscal 2025 budget totals $3.3 billion. The White House has proposed cutting that by more than $1 billion for the next fiscal year, which starts in October 2025. Next, Zion, Utah. For 1,946,592 visitors in 2024. With its jagged red rock mountains, immense vistas, and steep canyons, Zion is a place that reminds you just how vast the American West remains. It's among the country's busiest national parks, famous both for the Narrows, a slot canyon carved by the Virgin River, and Angel's Landing, an ascent so perilous that climbers grasp chain ropes along the way, and so popular that they have to win a lottery space to attempt it. I was a first-time guest and met others like me, including a Kentucky couple celebrating their 35th anniversary as bighorn sheep bleated below them. But many were repeat visitors, and they were unsure what they'd find given the actions out of Washington, which initially had Zion losing a dozen rangers and 100 seasonal employees. I was a little bit concerned. Was there going to be enough services, enough people around to help? Said 54-year-old Catherine Hedrick of Wilmington, North Carolina, a former Zion tour guide who was on a trip with longtime friends. What's going to happen when people get lost or fall? Moments later, I noticed a young woman sitting on the ground, her head bloodied. Someone said she'd been bitten by a squirrel. Two rangers and an EMS worker arrived on the scene and soon wheeled her out on a rugged stretcher, underscoring the need for trained staffers in an often harsh environment. I later watched a ranger show several Mennonite hikers a rare snail, the wet rock Faiza, as it crawled amid ferns on a canyon wall. Zion is the only place in the world that the tiny creature is found. "I worry about the things you can't see," said Andrew Helleran, 43, a product manager from Littleton, Massachusetts, who was traveling with his wife, Jen, and two kids, Ella, 8, and Braden, 9. Fourth graders like Braden get free entrance to national parks under the government's Every Kid Outdoors program, among the reasons for the family's first vacation to Zion. Folks like Aaron Rex, 51, an electrical engineer from Columbus, Ohio, didn't detect signs of the budget cuts, which, as a Trump voter, he supported. Bathrooms at the visitor's center and other prime spots were open, Rex noted, and park staff appeared to be clearing trash from trails. But other visitors told me they noticed empty entrance booths, lax parking enforcement, and shuttered bathrooms replaced in places by porta-potties near the Narrows trailhead. I started to wonder about staffing after I saw a massive cottonwood tree limb crash into the lodge parking lot. Nobody was injured, but nobody rushed to remove it either. Then one of the packed shuttle buses I rode around the park was delayed entry as we waited for a ranger to open a gate. Most rangers, and even park volunteers, said they were barred from discussing the federal funding situation. But a few were willing to talk. A still new ranger pointed to delays in various repairs and planned improvements within Zion. The popular Weeping Rock Trail, for instance, was still shuttered because of a rock slide. Morale also has been damaged, according to Ray Swigert, 77, a retired history teacher and longtime volunteer who helps track the critically endangered California condors that make their home in Zion. He relishes educating visitors about the birds, and this summer was watching a pair that he hoped would soon mate. In our conversation, with black-streaked canyon walls as the backdrop, Swigert offered his personal thoughts about the park's challenges. He had only admiration for its rangers and other workers, calling them underpaid, underappreciated, understaffed. "They certainly deserve far more support than they get," he said. And this portion of a look at four national parks in the United States was written by Molly Hennessy Fisk. And a park fact: the National Park Service estimates its backlog of deferred maintenance was $22.9 billion at the end of fiscal year 2024. About this story, photos and video were taken by the reporter in each park. Story editing by Susan Levine. Copy editing by Gabby Morera de Nubila. Video production by Alyssa Shadiev-Koff. Video senior producing by Niti Upadhyay. Photo editing by Haley Hamblin. Illustrations and design by Zachary Balkoff. Design and development by Talia Trackham. Design editing by Virginia Singarayar. And graphics by Nick Mortuopoulos. And the writers. Karen Brouillard is a Colorado-based national reporter covering the American West. Previously, she was an international news editor, a foreign correspondent in South Africa, Pakistan, and Israel, and a local reporter. She joined the Post in 2003. Kim Belware covers national and breaking news for The Washington Post. Karen Miller-Pensiero is standards editor of The Washington Post, a role she created in 2025. She joined after a 38-year career at The Wall Street Journal, where she was managing editor and held a variety of senior roles, including standards editor. She has been senior advisor to NYU's Ethics and Journalism Initiative and a Pulitzer Prize juror. And Molly Hennessy Fisk joined The Post in 2022 as a national reporter based in Texas covering breaking news and red states. This article, "In Beloved National Parks, Summer Crowds Throng Despite Budget Cuts," appeared in the Washington Post on Wednesday, July 30th, 2025. And now for two New York Times trilobites. Starry skies may guide bogong moths home. A new study suggests that these Australian insects may be the first invertebrates to use the night sky as a compass during migration. Published on June 18, 2025 in the New York Times, this article is written by Alexa Robles-Gill. In the summer, the walls of the caves in the Australian Alps are tiled with bogong moths. Months before, billions of these small nocturnal insects migrate about 600 miles to this destination, a place they have never visited before. Seeking refuge from the summer heat, they travel across southeast Australia to these cool alpine caves. Then, in the fall, they migrate back to their breeding grounds where they eventually die. This remarkable journey has long puzzled scientists like Eric Warrant, a neurobiologist at Lund University in Sweden. "How on earth do these moths know where to go?" he said. Now, a study in the journal Nature by Dr. Warrant and his colleagues reveals the details of the insect's impressive feat, showing that the bogong moth may be the first invertebrate to use the starry night sky for migration. The findings suggest the insects use a set of internal compasses, one guided by the Earth's magnetic field and the other by the night sky, to reach their destination. That an insect brain that is smaller than the grain of rice is able to do this is just remarkable, said Basil Iljundi, a neuroscientist at the University of Oldenburg in Germany, who was not involved in the study. The Australian bogong moth could fit in the palm of your hand. It has a 2-inch long wingspan, a small set of eyes, and a brain that is roughly a tenth of the volume of a grain of rice. Despite their small size, they have played a big role in Australia. Once an important source of food for Indigenous Australians, the insect also holds a strong cultural value because of its impressive migration. Few insects undertake long-distance migration from dispersed breeding grounds to meet in a single, specific destination. The most famous example is the monarch butterfly, which relies on the sun as a visual compass. Like monarchs, bogong moths use the Earth's magnetic field for their long journey. They combine the magnetic compass with visual cues or markers, though researchers did not know what these were. To study which visual markers these creatures were using to migrate, the team created a flight simulator for captured moths. But catching these insects was no easy feat. After a series of droughts and wildfires spread across Australia from 2017 to 2020, bogong moth populations collapsed by 99.5%, according to researchers. Before the droughts, the cave walls could hold millions of moths. After, the caves were essentially devoid of them. "It was terrible," Dr. Warrant said. The droughts eventually broke with the destructive wildfires that scorched Australia in 2020. Toward the end of the droughts, the team caught enough moths to conduct its experiments. The researchers placed the insects inside a lab-controlled simulator to test their behavior. They created a type of magnetic vacuum, stripping away the magnetic field inside the simulator. This allowed them to isolate the two compass systems and study only the visual one. The creature was tethered in the simulator, and the team projected the night sky on top, like a planetarium. They found that in the absence of the magnetic compass, the stars and the Milky Way were enough for the moth to orient itself in its migratory flight. If the researchers turned the projected sky 180 degrees, the moth would also turn. "That was a huge surprise," Dr. Warrant said. "They could actually interpret the stars to find a geographic direction." To fully understand the navigation system, the team also studied the visual neurons in the moth's brain to confirm if the neural responses matched the behavior. In the experiment, the team inserted tiny electrodes into the insect's brain. By doing so, they measured the neuron's response to the same starry sky that provoked the behavioral response. As in the first experiment, the moth's neurons responded to the sky's rotation. "The behavior and the neurobiology are hand in hand," said Roy Ristman, a biologist at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio, who was not involved in the study. Whenever you see a paper that does both of those things, that's a really cool thing. The two different compasses might be helpful when conditions favor one over the other, Dr. Ritzman said. For example, if there are cloudy skies or if the insect's magnetic compass is knocked out, having two maps is probably better than having one map, he added. Dr. Warren said the study was born out of utter curiosity and awe and opened up new avenues of research. How do the magnetic and night sky compasses work together? Is one more dominant than the other? Once the moths arrive in the mountains, are there other cues that lead them to the caves? We've always thought, oh, they are just simple animals, they just fly toward light, and those kinds of things, Dr. El-Jundi said. But the brain network and the ability of these animals to perform quite extraordinary and complex navigational tasks is just mind-blowing. The author, Alexa Robles-Gil, is a science reporter and a member of the 2025-2026 Times Fellowship Class, a program for journalists early in their careers. This New York Times trilobite, Starry Skies May Guide Mogong Moths Home, was published on June 18, 2025. From Advances in the April 2025 issue of Scientific American, in the Department of Collective Behavior, crawling traffic. Ants' strategies could help self-driving cars avoid traffic jams. From an airplane, cars crawling down the highway look like ants. But actual ants, unlike cars, somehow managed to avoid the scourge of stop-and-go traffic. Researchers are now studying these insects' cooperative tactics to learn how to program self-driving cars that don't jam up. The free flow of traffic becomes unstable as the density of cars increases on a highway. At 15 vehicles per mile per lane, one driver tapping their brakes can trigger a persistent wave of congestion. It's a kind of phase transition, like water turning from a liquid to a solid form, says Katsuhiro Nishinari, a mathematical physicist at the University of Tokyo, who studies these jamming transitions. Nishinari's previous research had shown that foraging ants can maintain their flow even at high densities. So what's their secret? In a recent study published in the journal Transportation Research Interdisciplinary Perspectives, researchers recorded Ochotelus ants on foraging trails and used traffic engineering models to analyze their movement. They found that the ants don't jam because they travel in groups of 3 to 20 that move at nearly constant rates while keeping good distances between one another, and they don't speed up to pass others. Human drivers at rush hour are hardly inclined to follow such rules. We are maximizing the interests of individuals, which is why at a given point you start to have a traffic jam, says study co-author Nicola Pugno, who studies sustainable engineering at the University of Trento in Italy. But self-driving cars, if they one day become ubiquitous, could have more cooperative programming. In one vision of this future, autonomous vehicles could share information with nearby cars to optimize traffic flow, perhaps, the researchers suggest, by prioritizing constant speeds and headways or by not passing others on the road. This vehicle network would be analogous to ants on a trail, which use scent to coordinate behavior while interacting with one another. There is no leader, but this organization emerges anyway, says Noah Pinter-Wollman, a behavioral scientist currently studying ants at the University of California in Los Angeles. And in both ant and vehicle traffic, this type of distributed system can be very, very strong and resilient, Nishinari says. Neither Nishinari nor Pinter-Wollman was involved in the new research. Still, ants can do a lot of things that cars, even self-driving ones, can't. Pinter-Wollman points out, ants can forage trails as wide as they like, unlike drivers stuck on highways. The insects do sometimes jam up when confined in tunnels, but to keep things moving, they'll find a way to walk on the ceiling, she says. Plus, unlike cars, ants don't crash. They can literally walk over one another. Today's drivers can learn at least one thing from ants to avoid causing traffic jam, Nishinari says. Don't tailgate. By leaving room between their car and the one ahead of them, drivers can absorb a wave of braking in dense traffic, conditions that would otherwise be amplified into a full-blown phantom traffic jam with no obvious cause. Drivers can absorb a wave of braking in dense traffic conditions that would otherwise be amplified into a full-blown phantom traffic jam with no obvious cause. Just keeping away, he says, can help traffic flow smoothly. This article, Crawling Traffic, in the Department of Collective Behavior, in the April 2025 issue of Scientific American, was written by Allison Parshall. From the Department of Biology, Microbiology, in the same issue of Scientific American, Sweet Gut, a microbe could be steering us toward the candy aisle. We might hate to admit it, but we aren't in complete control of our own bodies. Bacteria can sometimes reign supreme, even in our hankering for a cookie or a glass of sweet tea. A recent study in the journal Nature Microbiology identifies a connection between the abundance of a common bacterium in a person's gut and the amount of sugar the person consumes. The results could help researchers develop novel treatments for a variety of metabolic conditions. Yongqiu Chen, a cancer biologist at China's Jiangnan University, and his team had been investigating the role of a protein called free fatty acid receptor 4, FFAR4, in mice's fat metabolism process. Initially, they put the rodents on a high-fat diet. One day, I suggested using a high-carbohydrate, high-sugar diet for comparison, and the results were surprising, Chen says. We expected that a fatty acid receptor may regulate fat preference. Surprisingly, it modulates sugar craving instead. Chen's team found that less FFAR4 in mice correlated with a greater preference for the high-sugar diet. The researchers also compared FFAR4 levels in both mice and humans with diabetes with those in counterparts without the condition, and the levels turned out to be significantly lower in the diabetes group. That's where the gut microbiome comes in. The scientists also found that in mice, lower FFAR4 levels were tied to a decreased abundance of a gut microbe called Bacteroides vulgatus. The researchers investigated how this bacterium might be involved and found that a metabolite produced by B. vulgatus, pantothenate, better known as vitamin B5, triggers production of the hormone GLP-1, which regulates appetite. In other words, less FFAR4 means less of the gut microbe, and less pantothenate and less GLP-1. This newly identified interplay of receptors, hormones, and appetite reveals just one of the stealthy ways our gut microbes work to keep us healthy. I was happy to find that the study further supports the existence of intrinsic interactions between host and microbiome, says Dr. Fetisoff, a physiologist at the University of Rouen, Normandy, in France, who was not involved in the research. He says the identification of pantothenate from the microbiome as a molecule that stimulates GLP-1 secretion and reduces sugar preference is a major finding because it could open up new treatments for type 2 diabetes. Alyssa Caffrey, a microbiology and immunology doctorate candidate at Stanford University, agrees, noting the potential of vitamin B5 supplementation or even a drug to increase the amount of FFAR4, although more research, including clinical trials, is needed first. Caffrey was also not involved in the study. But there are still unanswered questions. The microbiome isn't the only microbe that influences GLP-1 production. B. vulgatus isn't the only microbe that influences GLP-1 production. Fetisoff's team previously found that Escherichia coli also stimulates its release. Comparing B. vulgatus with other GLP-regulating factors needs further exploration, Chen says. This article filed by Claire Maldorelli. Next, this dinosaur probably tweeted more than it roared. The anatomy of a Chinese fossil offers a hint that birdsong may be as old as the dinosaurs themselves. Published on July 18, 2025, and written by Asher Elbine. Since the 1930s, dinosaurs have rumbled, snarled, and roared on film. But the fossilized inspirations for these cinematic creatures have preserved little evidence for any such dramatic voices. In a paper published last week in the journal PeerJ, researchers announced the discovery of a fossilized herbivorous dinosaur from China, preserving a surprisingly bird-like throat. It provides a clue that the origins of birdsong might go as far back as the beginning of dinosaurs themselves. The 2-foot-long dinosaur, which the researchers named Pulauosaurus, was discovered in 163-million-year-old rocks in northeastern China, said Jing Zhu, a paleontologist at the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing and an author of the paper. The largely complete skeleton offers a strong and anatomical view into the fleet-footed beaked animal, an early member of the family that later produced duck-billed, hadrosaurs, and horned dinosaurs. The Jurassic period formation that produced Pulauosaurus is also the source of other dinosaur discoveries like the feathered proto-bird Anchiornis, the tiny bat-like Yi Qi, and the feathered herbivorous dinosaur Tianyulong. Unlike those animals, Pulauosaurus is not preserved with obvious soft tissues that could help better explain its living appearance. On some parts of the fossil, we thought we'd find very thin filaments, but we can't confirm that, Dr. Zhu said. The team did note interesting formations in the stomach region of the fossil, but hasn't determined what those are. They could be stomach contents, food eaten by this dinosaur, or organs, or maybe even eggs within the body, Dr. Zhu said. The most interesting remains were found within the throat. In vertebrates, vocal organs play an important role in protecting the airway and helping produce everything from simple hisses and grunts to speech. In most living reptiles, these tissues are composed of cartilage and can produce simple bellows, grunts, groans, and chirps. Modern birds have vocal organs made up partially of delicate bones, allowing them to make much more complicated sounds, including, in some cases, mimicking human speech. The anatomy of dinosaur vocal organs has long been a mystery. Even when you have a dinosaur skeleton preserved, you don't always have these isolated bones preserved with other skull elements, Dr. Zhu said. They're very thin bones, very delicate and hard to preserve. The first report of a non-bird dinosaur with fossilized vocal organs, the armored ankylosaur Pinacosaurus, which lived millions of years after Pulauosaurus, arrived only in 2023. While Pinacosaurus lacked the distinct voice box seen in birds, the researchers concluded its bony larynx was large and mobile enough to possibly help produce bird-like noises. Pulauosaurus seems to have had a similar vocal setup, Dr. Zhu said, albeit one that was less developed. Pulauosaurus and Pinacosaurus belong to dinosaur families separated from each other by millenniums of evolution. Each is also distant from the lineage that produced modern birds. While it's possible that they evolved independently in different lineages, Dr. Zhu said, the presence of similar vocal organs in distinct groups suggests that bird-like vocals might have emerged with dinosaurs' earliest ancestors over 230 million years ago. For now, the more complex vocal machinery found in everything from parrots to penguins, specifically their voice box, the syrinx, remains unknown in non-bird dinosaurs. But they might turn up one day in a well-preserved fossil, Dr. Zhu said. It's even possible that they already have and were simply misidentified, as the tiny, delicate bones are easy to miss. We hope that in the future we can find more specialized structures relating to sound, so we can do research on how dinosaurs produced their voices, Dr. Zhu said. So what did Pulawasaurus sound like? Did it twitter, squeak, or chirp like a baby crocodile? We don't know, Dr. Zhu said. It could be some strange noise. This New York Times trilobite, posted on July 18, 2025, tells us that this dinosaur probably tweeted more than it roared. The anatomy of a Chinese fossil offers a hint that birdsong may be as old as the dinosaurs themselves. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.